All right, well, welcome to the Mary Hagen Dumont University here at Anshe Sefarad Beth Lemeth Congregation here in Memphis, Tennessee. We welcome everyone who's on the call with us, on the Zoom with us. Great to have you with us. The Mary Dumont University often discusses various topics, so we're discussing Torah and science this week, Torah and nature, and we'll discuss next week, 7 o'clock, back to 7, we're going to discuss Torah and health. That'll be next week. The Torah and nature. We had a lecture a while back on Tu B'Shvat of, I think, 2020, where Rabbi Moshe Tarrigan spoke about his thoughts on Torah and nature, Judaism and nature. And I do draw somewhat on his thoughts, and I want to expand it beyond that as well, if possible. All right. So let's get started with our discussion. So Torah and nature. When we think about our relationship, the relationship of Torah and nature, you might feel that they're sort of antagonistic forces. Natural world, you know, anything goes. Whatever's natural is good. If as long as it's natural, then it's fine. If that's what goes on in nature, it's good. You say that, you know, in nature, the big fish swallows a small fish. So that's natural. So that's the way it goes. And Torah seems to be guided by morality, etc. But we're going to show tonight that there's a deep relationship between Torah and nature. It's interesting, in Hebrew, I was, you know, Googling it and looking for things about it. The word teva, nature, we think of nature in terms of natural world. We also think of the great outdoors, the forest, the animals. In Hebrew, the word teva, it relates to the idea of the natural versus the supernatural. I'm not sure it relates so much to nature as in, you know, the beautiful trees outside or something like that. So just a little note about the Hebrew aspects. So we're going to talk about four relationships of nature to humanity. Number one, what's the relationship of the Jew to nature? Nature tells the glory of God. Hashamayim esaparim kvodel. Maaseh adav, magid harakim. The heavens declare the glory of God. The sky proclaims his handiwork. You see a beautiful vista. You see the Grand Canyon, great lake, a great ocean, a great wave. We see the glory of God, and the skies tell of the glory of God. You know, we don't see the sky today. We have a lot of light pollution. When you actually see an actual sky, you see the wonders of the heavens. It's inspiring. It tells us about the glory. Or as we say, Baruch Hinafshi, and we mentioned every morning as well, Ma Rabu Mazach Hashem, oh, how many things you have made, or how great are your deeds, O God. Kulam L'chokma Zidan, you made them all with wisdom. Malah Haaretz Kirnecha, the world is filled with your creations and things that you acquire, that you put your stamp on. So certainly there's an inspiration that comes from nature, no question about that. This is fairly obvious. I just want to start with this point. That was 1A. 1B, nature is often the impetus for faith. So for instance, the Rambam, Hilchos Yesodei HaTorah, the laws of the foundations of the Torah, he talks about how a person comes to faith. How may one discover the way to love and fear him? The person will reflect concerning his God's works and God's great wonderful creatures. But he must make thorough study and will behold through them his wonderful, matchless, and infinite wisdom, will spontaneously be filled with love, praise, and exaltation. So from nature, a person becomes filled with exaltation, become possessed with a great longing to know the great name. We're going to talk about that later, the longing to God. Even as David said, my soul thirsts for God, the living God. And we will think of all these matters. To be taken back in a moment and stricken with awe. So he moves from love to awe. So nature both inspires love. Oh, look, God is so wonderful. Look at all the things he made. And then awe. To realize that he's an infinitesimal creature, humble and dark, set with an insignificant, slight knowledge of in the fingers. And of what use is man that we remember him and the harm with these matters, etc. So the nature as an impetus for faith, both love and apropos to that, the smallness of the human being. You see the vastness of the universe, right? How many billions of galaxies are there? How many billions of planets are there? Right? And how small we are just within this little galaxy in which we live. It's unbelievable. And this is very much brought out in Job. Right? Job has a problem. He says, I don't understand God. How come bad things are happening to me? So he says, what? You don't know anything. The world is so vast. The creatures are so magnificent. And what do you know about them? Can you draw a Leviathan by a fish hook? Can you press down a tongue by a rock? Here's his jaw with a barb. Do you have any one percentage of the power that God has to deal with the powerful forces of nova and supernova and suns and all that? Do you have any idea what sort of powering intellect I have and ability over you? You want to understand the universe. So nature makes us feel small and reminds us that, all right, we don't have all the answers to all the questions about God. We're not going to. Job tells us, we have no way of knowing everything. Smallness of the universe. Then I thought Rabbi Tarvin made an excellent point. And we talk about morality in nature. So, as Rabbi Chiya, we turn to the Gemara in Eruv in 100b. Rabbi Chiya said, what is the meaning of that which is written? Who teaches us by the beasts of the earth and makes us wiser by the birds of the sky? Who teaches us by the beasts of the earth? That is the female mule, which crouches and urinates, from which we learn modesty. Right? The mule teaches us modesty and makes us wiser by the birds of the sky. This is the rooster, which first cajoles and then mates with the hen. So we learn some things about human modesty and behavior from these different creatures. And Rabbi Yochanan, more famously, in the next statement, says, if even the Torah had not been given, we would have learned sne'ut michatul. I could have learned modesty from a cat. Gazelle minamalai. I could have learned not to steal from an ant. Arayot miona. I could have learned modesty of not leaving your spouse from a dove. Derech eretz, tarigol, how to populate and all that from a chicken. And Jebephizer, I would. So I could have learned all these things. So in other words, what's our relationship to nature? Nature educates. There's morality in nature. After all, Proverbs 6, go learn from the ant. Lech on the malatzel, you lazy, no good Nick. Go learn from the ant. Re'ed rachev achakam. See the ways of the ant and learn something. Shereen la'ketzin shoter moshel. As far as we know, when we look at the ants, they don't seem to have any chief ants or rulers. And yet, it lays up its stores during the summer. It works hard during the summer, so it's going to have food for later. That's what you should be like. Save money, work hard, learn from the ant. So what's our relationship to nature? We learn morality, we learn goodness, we learn how to be the right type of person from nature. So here I want to go beyond Rabbi Tarkin a bit. Because not only do we learn morality, in general, we also learn what a moral being God is as well. Psalm 147, toward the end of Psalms, we say it every morning, God gives food to the beasts. The ravens brood what they cry for. Right? So when the ravens brood is crying, you know, they go, squaw, squaw. All of a sudden, somehow, there's a worm, there's a, whatever you feed ravens, there's something that for every animal, every creature, there's something out there to feed them. As we say in Psalm 104, which is all about nature, or how, right, Nathan Greenblatt once put it, it's how the wicked people ruined nature. Everything was beautiful until the wicked people came along. He says, all of them look to you, all the creatures look to you to give them their food when it's due. They expect, right? The lion roars, he expects that he wakes up, there's going to be some zebra, you can go eat them. The birds go out to look for stuff, and then there are going to be worms in the ground for them to eat. Den lam yil kotun, give it to them, they gather it up. Tiftach yadcha yisbunto. Open your hand, they are well satisfied. Every creature that's alive is satisfied. I mean, there's some who don't get anything, they're dead. But those who are alive, they always have something to eat. God makes the world that the anthropic principle, right? That everything in the world is the way it should be, so that animals, people, birds, trees, everything can live and breathe because God provides for all. So it shows the morality, the goodness of God. How do we know God is good? Not just from the Torah. We know it from the fact that there's living creature. There are living creatures on this earth, and God provides for them. Or we say in the morning Psalms, God does justice for those who were wrong. God gives bread to the poor, to the starving. God lets those who were prisoners, he sets them free. God restores the sight to the blind. Lord makes those who are bent stand straight. Now, you say to yourself, well, where does God do that? When does God do that? Any thoughts? How do we know that God does that? God watches over the stranger. He gives courage to the orphan and the widow. Makes the path of the wicked tortuous. How do we know that God cares about the hungry? Those who are prisoners, blind. Anybody? So I would say that when we see prisoners go free, we see that God helps the prisoner. We see someone who is downtrodden, now they're running the bank. We see that somehow in life, nature in life, you can see the morality of God. God sometimes, has a sense of humor about how things work. That's maybe slightly different. In Parshat Ekev, we have the idea that God is great and he doesn't take bribes, and he does upholds the cause of the fatherless and the widow. A friend is a stranger providing food and clothing. But when somehow the widow, the orphan who should be starving in the street, somehow they're provided for. Some guy takes an interest in them, or somebody gives them charity, or they make a living somehow, they eke out a living. At that point, you say, God provided, that somehow God cares about these folks. So from nature, life, morality, we learn some morality as well. God, as it says in Asherai, God opens his hand, God gives everything, the three interpretations, either whatever, God gives something that he wants to give to everybody, or God gives something that everybody wants to everybody. Everyone gets something of what they want. Or that God gives grace to everyone. There's some grace in everyone's life. Even the quadriplegic, there's some grace in the life. Or Tov Hashem Lakol, also Psalm 145, God is good to all, his mercies on all his creatures. So here's the idea that God is merciful not only to me, but God is merciful to all creatures. Our relationship to nature, God cares about nature. He cares about all the creatures. This is a basis of the idea that we shouldn't cause any pain to animals unless it's for human use. We shouldn't cause pain to animals because God has mercy on all his creatures, not just human beings. So in the end, the idea of nature telling God's glory, nature as impetus of faith, so in our smallness, we talked about morality, which you can learn from nature, things you can learn from nature. And then I thought one of Rabbi Targan's most beautiful points is that one day nature will be in sync with God. Now, we ask, how do you know what God is like? How do you know what God wants? So you can look in the Bible, you can look in the Torah, and you can also look at nature to some degree as well. And therefore, the will of God can be seen from nature and the Torah. At some point, nature and God's will should be in complete sync. Now, when someone, like this week we saw in our community, young boy died, looks like God's will and nature don't seem to be in sync. But one day, God, they will be in sync. Exodus 11. In the story of Exodus, all of creation was at the same, was in it together. And therefore, the dog didn't bark. What happened? The Egyptians were crying from the loss of their children from the plague of the firstborn. Among the Jews, there wasn't a sound. Not a sound? What about the dogs? No, the dogs didn't make any sounds. The dogs were helping to show that you have to listen to God. You can't not listen to God. The dogs were in sync with God's will. Or every Friday night we say, Narotim Chaukaf, Yacharim Ranin, let the rivers clap their hands, the mountains sing joyously together. Why? The presence of the Lord. He's coming to rule the earth. He'll rule the world justly, and his peoples with equity. When God comes to rule the earth, the rivers will clap their hands. The mountains will sing together. Everything, all of nature will be happy. The grass will smile a little bit more. Rabbi Soloveitchik said that his grandfather said that, how do we know when Mashiach comes? That day the grass will just be a little greener than it usually is. Everything will be more beautiful. The sun will shine a little better. Somehow, there is a dream of a day when all of nature will sing together harmoniously in sync with God's will. We say it in Hallel regarding the splitting of the sea, right? In front of whom does the sea tremble? Tremble, O Lord, the presence of the Lord, the presence of the God of Jacob, who turned the rock into a pool of water, a flinty rock into a mountain. So, what did the sea see that it ran? It saw the God is coming. It moved aside. There is an idea that one day nature will reflect God even more than it does today. Good. Now I'd like to talk about something that Targum did not talk about. And it's in this wonderful book called The Emergence of Ethical Man by Rabbi Joseph B. Salinger. This is really one of the most radical books he ever wrote. And some people, so much so that some people even say that that maybe the book shouldn't have come out because the book is perhaps expresses some ideas that are more radical than what he wanted to publicize. That maybe that's why he never publicized it in his lifetime. It's a posthumously published book. And there's some ethical problems with publishing something posthumous. But in that, he makes a very interesting argument. And let's take a look. I think he wrote it about 1960. Now, around 1960, there was a lot of interest in nature and vegetarianism and getting back to nature and things like that. So it may fit into that as well. Let's take a look again at that slide. So he claims that we are part of nature. For instance, in Genesis, it says, and man called the animals and all the birds, he called them names, but he couldn't find one that was fitting for him. He related to all the creatures. What does it mean to call someone a name? Oh, you're a bird. Your name is Joe. Your name is, hey, buddy. Hey, sweetie. Everyone has a name. He went over to the animals and he called each one a name, meaning there's a relationship of human being to every species. Rabbi Soloveitchik, the Rav, we are part of nature and outside of it. Our job is to transcend it, but we are part of nature as well. How do we know? Look at this first 7 days of creation, right? Why did God create the world and describe the world in the way he did? Again, according to Ramban, Rashi, all the commentaries say, Torah is not there to tell us exactly how the world was created, but it does describe a process in which there's a parallel between the trees being told to be fruitful and multiply, the animals being told to be fruitful and multiply, and the human beings being told to be fruitful and multiply, as if we're all part of one continuum. So he says the idea that somehow there's this tension between body and the soul, and he says, what nonsense. Look at the Bible. There's a continuum between the human being and all the creatures, from the lowest to the highest. The Rav, based on the book Family Redeemed, someone wrote the following. Both humans and animals belong to nature. Both sprang forth from the soil. Right? We say, Hamotzi lachem min haaretz. Where does the bread come from? From the ground. The difference is that humans are created in the image of God. This is not a gratuitous grant, or rather a challenge. What does it mean that we're image of God? Some people think it means that we're completely different from animals, have nothing in common with them. No, it's a challenge. Man is encouraged to use his distinctness to build, to plant, to beautify his life, to enjoy his life as much as he can. His earthly role is to create, change, improve, and make improvement and progress. To create change, improvement, and progress. So here he's claiming that we do have a role of changing nature, But it, the important line, I think, for these purposes right this second, are both humans and animals belong to nature, both sprang forth from the soil. Right? What does it say? You are dust and you shall return to dust. Right? Where do we insist on being buried? In the ground. Right? There's an idea. The word Adam itself means Adama, dirt. There is an idea we are earthly, that the human being is earthly. The idea, he says, about Christians, introduced Jews sometimes fell for it, that somehow we possess a soul, we're transcendental. He says, of course, we have a soul. We'll talk about what that means, but it doesn't mean that we're not part of earth. Yoram Chazoni is a great thinker in Israel. I think the institute that he used to head is now being headed by Joe Roberts' brother. Anyway, so he wrote a book review of this book, Emergence of the Ethical Man. And so first he quotes something and then he explains. Man is as a natural being suddenly begins to discover in himself not only identity, but also immeasurable incommensurability with nature. Thus, he enters a new phase of viewing nature from a distance. His personality begins to assume shape, and the ethical norm attains its full meaning. Man experiences the ethical must, not as a natural necessity, which he cannot flee, but as a unique imperative, which if he decides to do so, he may disobey and ignore. Consciousness of freedom begins to dawn on him. So he talks about the emergence of ethical man, but a man starts not as ethical man, but as natural man. In a sense, the image of God for Soloveitchik does involve the ability to overcome natural life. But Rabbi Soloveitchik emphasizes that this distancing of man from natural life does not in Hebrew scripture involve any turn to the supernatural. What he calls personality or freedom to choose to naturalize an ethical impulse does not connote anything supernatural or transcendental. It signifies only the emergent subjectivity in man. It signifies, in other words, development of the ability to mount a critique of nature as man finds it. When we find that there are poor people who are part of the natural system, that there are animals that are as a stray dog, we may want to critique it. We may want to give charity. We may want to adopt that dog. We want to help that poor person, that homeless person. But it's something that no other living things can do. Man comes to regard nature as being, to a certain extent, alien, for discerning the possibility of choosing against nature. So on the one hand, we're part of nature. On the other hand, we look at nature objectively and say, wait, can I do anything to improve this thing? And I have an ethical imperative to try to do that, and I have a freedom to either do that or not. So how does man appear in Genesis? As a part of creation or separate from it? Well, right? The first 6 days is very much part of nature, but he has this unique thing of this image of God, whatever that means, we'll talk about. And why is man compared to a tree? Why do we say in Isaiah 40, "Kol habasar chatzir," all man is grass. I'm sorry, not flesh. All flesh is grass. Where man is no more than an animal for all his vanity, Kohelet. There is an admission in the biblical literature, unlike the medieval literature, where there's this tension between the body and the soul. In true Jewish literature, namely the Bible itself and its attendant oral tradition, there is an acceptance that the human being is part of the natural realm. All right, so Soloveitchik said that if you want to know Jewish philosophy, you can't just look at Jewish philosophers. You have to look at the halacha, look at Jewish law in the Torah, from the rabbi, and you'll see the philosophy of law. We have prohibitions on organic matter. For instance, we do not own the land. You can't reap during Shemitah. You can't change the nature of the trees. Some food is forbidden until we tithe it. But there's no relationship, no mitzvah to the inorganic. Right? If you see plowing as part of preparation of the tree. So he claims that our relationship is to the natural world, meaning the organic world. We are part of the organic world. Since we're part of it, we relate to it. We have mitzvot that relate to how to treat a tree. You can't knock it down if you don't have any purpose. But we have no rules about knocking down a rock because we're not in relationship with the inorganic. but only in the organic. Now, Rabbi Soloveitchik sort of making the argument of this passage in the Talmud. He didn't quote it, not exactly. It says there are six statements which were said in regards to humans. Three ways were like ministering angels, and three ways were like animals. Three ways were like ministering angels, that we have intelligence like angels, walk upright like angels, meaning we can go, we're free, not like a tree who's planted. We can go where we want to go. They speak in the holy tongue like the ministering angels. Three ways were like animals. We eat, drink like animals, we multiply, fruitful like animals, we emit excrement like animals. So, all right, Soloveitchik is pointing out that the latter point, that we are part of, we are part of the animal kingdom. We don't disagree with that. That we are, we do flow from plant, animal, human. There is a nexus, there's a relationship, connection between the three, the plant, the animal, and the human being. That's why we have rules of how to treat animals, which animals we can eat, which animals we can sacrifice. How do we go from being natural man, natural human being, to being spiritual beings? And I'm sorry, Rabbi Soloveitchik always uses the word man. It's one of his favorite words. Of course, he means the human. Rabbi Soloveitchik said, the Rav said, you know how we become spiritual? Because man as animal needs faith. Let's think about that. Man, not as spiritual being, needs God. No. Man as an animal needs God, needs faith. Our natural state is that we get lonely and people reach out to God. And if I read, no atheist in a foxhole, when you're lonely, reach out to God. God made Abraham lonely. He said, I don't want you to be with your family. Leave, go somewhere else. Oh, you're lonely? Reach out to me. Adam can't find community in the natural world. Abraham is forced to be lonely and he finds God. So man, it's not that he's a very radical state. You might say because we have a soul and we're like angels, that's why we relate to God. He says, no, it's because you're an animal. You know what animals do? They long for things. Most animals long for a lunch. They yearn for some water on a hot day. They yearn for eating an animal when they can't find one. They roar so they can find it as something to eat. But the human being also yearns, as it says in the Psalms, like gazelle who's pining away for some water. So that's how my soul longs for God. It's part of my natural state. It's part of the idea that the human being is lonely and we naturally reach out to God. It's not a supernatural thing. He wants to claim that the human being functions within a normative plane. So what's the image of God? It's due to divine communication, revelation. When we speak to God, we have the image of God is that we speak to God. It's not because you have some endowment that's different. I mean, I realize this is not what you usually hear. Usually you would say that our soul is part of God. You would say that the soul is a spiritual being. It's like an angel or something. It's eternal. And therefore it relates to God. He says, no. It's very simple. God communicates with us. You read the Torah and then we relate to what God said. That's how we have an image of God. We long for God. That's how we have a spiritual side. Very radical kind of a notion of human being as part of the natural world. We look at something from the book called And From There You Shall See, this longing, born of the instinct to continue one's biological existence, as implanted in man, finds expression in man running toward God. The sexual longing that a person desires, whatever it is, that longing, it can be, there's a side of it that can be identical to the longing for God. But in a natural state, longs and desires, and part of that can be, in a natural way, longing for God. Radical notion of our relationship to nature as spiritual beings is that we are naturally inclined to look for something higher power. The Soviet Union tried to stomp out God, and I think they took a survey. I think 80% of Russians believe in God. Some of them go to church. They stomped out a lot of church. But a tremendous percent of Russians believe in God, despite the indoctrination to communism, many Jewish Russians took for granted that there's no God because of their education. But today, most Russians believe in God. Go tell me there isn't a natural longing for God. Man is organic. If man was defined by logos, by reason, oh, you know why we're humans? Because we have reason. Then, if we were defined by reason, then the unborn baby, you could just have an abortion whenever you feel like it. You shouldn't have any compunction at all. Because it's we're a dying patient. Walk over, pull the plug out, get chop off his head. What difference does it make? He's dying anyway. There's no cognition. The human being is only cognition and logos. A fetus should have no status. Again, we're not saying you can never have an abortion. Circumstances under which many rabbis allow abortions, and what term it is, depending on the circumstance, etc. But the idea that you just wantonly destroy a fetus? No. Why? After all, it doesn't have logic. It doesn't think. A dying patient at some point is basically a vegetable. But when you say that human being, something that has the structure of a human being, his eyes, nose, and ears, and he's dying, he's still, it would be murder to kill him at that point. Again, there are circumstances on which you can stop certain life-sustaining measures and all that. But someone is truly alive, right? They're sitting there in a bed, not hooked up to anything in their life. They are alive because Rabbi Soloveitchik wants to define the human being as an organic being. You say, oh, he's only a vegetable. No, a human being that looks like a human being and he acts like a vegetable because he has no logic, he has no mind, still a human being. You kill him, it's murder. According to Maimonides, theoretically, the unborn and the vegetative state is not human. But Rabbi Soloveitchik says, no, obviously that's not true. The halacha says otherwise. The halacha says don't kill the dying patient. The unborn baby has some juridic right. And therefore, what is the halacha telling us? What's the philosophy of the halacha? The human being is an organic human being, not just a logical being, but also an organic being. And back to last week, Torah and evolution. Do we disagree that we are part of the continuum of life? This week we're talking about nature and Torah. Last week we were talking about Torah and science. One of the premises of biological science is evolution. So we wonder, well, one of the premises of evolution is that we're part of a continuum of life, that our DNA is the same as a plant, except we just have more. So do we disagree with that? Are we offended by the notion that there's a connection between us and a monkey? So Rabbi Soloveitchik would say, what? Absolutely not. We're not offended by that at all. We do not disagree that we're part of the continuum of life. All right, so those are the four points. We are part of nature. One day we'll be in sync with God. The morality we learn from nature and faith we learn from nature. But now, some ands, ifs, or buts. So far, we're very pro-nature. This whole book about the emergence of ethical man posits the notion of the human being as very much connected to nature. However, limits of nature. So someone once said, I'm not sure, I thought it was maybe C.S. Lewis, I'm not sure. We started by saying the heavens sing the praises of God. So it may sing God's praises, but it doesn't tell you what to do. It doesn't command. In other words, you look at nature, you say, oh, that's nice, beautiful tree. It doesn't tell you, so what should I do in my life? What am I supposed to do? C.S. Lewis was a Christian apologist, so we agree with him to the extent that he's making apologetics for religion, that's good, but the extent that he's describing Christianity, that we have to skip those chapters. So in the four loves, you have to skip the last chapter, but the other three chapters I was taught by my teachers that it's good to read. So he says there, if you take nature as a teacher, she will teach you exactly the lessons you had already deceased to learn. So I'm not sure even going to deceased. But anyway, in other words, nature does not teach. That's what he says. Nature does not teach. Now, the question is, isn't this an overstatement? We said in Proverbs, it's not true, that we can learn from nature, but it can't tell us everything, right? you can't pask in a shayla. You can't answer every halachic question or quandary or query you have because you look at a tree or you look at the cosmos. So it does teach us some things. And Rabbi Yochanan said, if we're really smart, we could have learned everything. But there's a lot of things that we don't learn. I don't know. Maybe not. Maybe I threw this out to some colleagues and said, well, who said this? He said, it's not what Rabbi Soloveitchik said. We can learn. But there could be some limitations. Or someone described Psalm 19, begins by saying, the heavens declare the glory of God, and the sky proclaims his handiwork. And at the end of the psalm, it says, and from the arrogant men or willful sins, keep your servant. Save me from either arrogant men or willful sins. Save me from sin. Let them not dominate me. Then I shall be blameless and clear of grave offense. If you can save me from sins, you know, I can't do it, but could you help me not do big sin? And then I'll be clean, and then I'll be great. So, in other words, that's what God can do. The psalm is talking about the glory of God, but the glory of nature cannot forgive you. It's only God that can forgive you. Nature can't forgive. It can't love you. It can't support you. What's the final verse of Psalm 19? You atzon mefi, the words of my mouth, and the thoughts of my heart. Hashem Tziriv Goli, God is my rock and my redeemer. So nature is not your rock. It may be a rock, but it's not your rock. And it's not your redeemer. It has no relationship with it. So, well, we are related to it, but I don't know if it can be your friend, right? So that's the problem with nature as just a standalone. Then there's the idea which we alluded to earlier in different writing of Rabbi Soloveitchik. We have to redeem nature, especially for one good example, as he describes in the book Family Redeemed, is the notion that we have to redeem the sexual drive. Maybe redeem it by longing for God. We have to redeem it by getting married, and having children, fulfilling the divine commandment to be fruitful and multiply. But again, it can go off in a direction that's negative. When we have a desire for Torah, we have anger, directed toward the shechita, the punishment of the wicked. You have jealousy, directed toward those who learn more Torah than you do. So you try to learn more Torah because you're jealous of those who learn more Torah. So we have to redeem these natural tendencies we have. We have to redeem them. So there's an idea that, you know, we're part of nature and all that. Wonderful. But there's also an idea that we have to go beyond it, beyond that scope. We had a passage here from myself, AJ, where he wrote that man experienced he has to mount a critique on nature, right? Man is encouraged to build and plant, to enjoy life, to create, to change, to improve, to make progress. So it's not just, you know, oh, natural, everything natural is great. There's also a command to subdue nature, to get in relationship with nature and to look at it from the outside. So we're inside the Rabbi Soloveitchik is very into dialectics. We're inside nature, we're part of nature, and we also look at it from the outside. And we look on the outside, we say, wait, the lions are eating the children. Well, let's put a fence over there and make sure that it's finally we could close on the notion from Rav Amital. Rav Amital was one of the heads of the yeshiva, Shibat Har Tzion, in Israel and Gush, and passed away not too long ago, and at least it seemed to me it wasn't too long ago. And he had an interesting idea that I kind of find him in some of his drashot, his teaching. He would look at various idolatries and say, no, idolatry is not that dumb. There's something to what they're doing. So for instance, I'll give you an example. There's a midrash that when the angels came into Abraham's house, he told them to wash their feet. Why? Because he thought they were idolaters. So why should they wash their feet? Because they were worshiping the dust on their feet. So he said, what a ridiculous type of worship. Worshiping the dust on their feet? So Rabbi Amital, Zechron Vacha, blessed memory, said, I'll explain to you. When some people worship themselves, what do they worship? The dust they walk on. So, right, as scientists, a lot of people worship the great discoveries as if they, you know, because they have a cell phone, therefore, you know, therefore we solve all the mysteries of life. So that's the idolatry of worshiping the dust on your feet. What about Pa'or? Pa'or is some sort of form of worship, again, whether this is just a you know, the way the Jews would think about it in order to make fun of it, or whether it's really true. But the rabbinic idea of Paul was that people would expose themselves, and that was part of the word. You expose yourself to the idol, and that was the worship. Maybe they would urinate or defecate on the idol, and that was how they worshiped. They had them in bathhouses and stuff like that. So, again, Rav Mital wants to say, what are they doing? Why would they do that? What, are they crazy? Well, why would someone worship that way? So he says, because one of the last things Moshe did was he made a battle against Peor, against this idol. And Pinchas destroyed those who worshipped the Peor. Because not everything natural is good. The Peor worshippers were saying, natural, right? Urination, defecation, it's natural, right? Exposing yourself, it's natural. So he says, not everything natural. And that relates to the Midrash, where Akiva told the Roman that we're better without the bris. We're better with the bris. The Roman said, come on, you have a beautiful body, and you guys are mutilating it. So he said, no. So you have wheat, and then you have bread. What's better, wheat or bread? Bread. Oh, bread is better, but you mutilated the wheat. So in other words, sometimes you can improve things. So we're here to, not everything natural is perfect. Sometimes we need to improve it. Sometimes it's not even good. There are things that animals do that we shouldn't do. We need to go beyond nature. So on the one hand, we're part of the natural world and we have a relationship with the natural world. We have responsibility to the natural world. On the other hand, we are asked to look at it from the outside and to be custodians of it, to work it, change it, and to try to adjust. So we've argued that there are four relationships of nature and human being. Firstly, in faith, telling the glory of God, use nature as inspiration. Sometimes it shows us the greatness of God and we love the love of God. Sometimes it inspires fear, as in the book of Job. We can learn some things from nature. If we look at certain animals, we look at the animal world, we can learn certain basic behaviors that are encoded in the nature. You know, when a robin makes a nest in your backyard, right? It's not an ethical choice. They just do it. But look how dutiful the mother is and father to make sure those eggs are well protected. You can learn something from nature. You can learn hard work, etc. Then we talked about how we can learn the morality of God. We can be inspired by how good God is by nature. And good God is to the creatures, to us, through nature. And we talked about that. Number three, we said that nature sometimes is not in sync with the will of God, and one day it will be. And that's perhaps our job as well, as human beings, to look at nature and say, wait, that aspect of nature is not, there are floods on the shore. We need to move the people off the shore so they won't get killed. It's our job to make sure that nature is in sync with God's will. One day we believe it will. And then the idea that Barry Salvation, this radical notion that we human beings are part of nature. Even what's unique about us is not necessarily something outside the organic realm, outside the animal realm. Even our longing for God is a natural thing. It stems from our longing for a lot of different things. And that he claims that in Genesis, we appear as part of the animal kingdom, and that's okay because we do have responsibility to the plant, we have a relationship to the plant, to the animal, and of course, to human beings. And therefore, we have mitzvot only to plants and animals, but we do not have such a relationship with inorganic things. And finally, our spirituality comes from the longing, which is the natural instinct, a longing for God. Interesting question, you know, is there a natural instinct to God? He's arguing. And finally, we said that there are limitations to nature. Perhaps it can't teach you everything. It's going to be ambiguous as to what it teaches. We said that nature is very nice, but it's God. It can be your friend, who can love you, it can be your rock and your redeemer. And also that there's things that need to be redeemed within nature. There are natural desires and things, feelings, and emotions that we have that need to be redeemed, that need to be fixed. And finally, Rav Amital points out that not everything natural is good. That's why the final battle of Moshe was against Peor, this idol worship, which worshiped everything natural. All right. With that, I conclude my formal presentation. And if anyone has any questions at this time, please chime in.